All right, let's continue here. So how did you end up, you were working in New Jersey for the New Jersey PIRG, doing all this amazing work, getting policies written and passed, and then other advocacy work around environmental issues. What eventually brought you to Philadelphia, and when?
Yeah, really the job. So it was a two-year sort of program, and I could have probably stayed on in New Jersey with them, but I was ready to leave the state. I never really thought about it until I was there, but I didn't like living in a place where I had to drive everywhere, basically.
Where were you in New Jersey?
I lived a few places. I lived in Trenton. Don't recommend it. I lived in, like, downtown Trenton. Really don't recommend it. I lived in New Brunswick, and I lived in Montclair, in the northern part of the state. But, you know, you can, like, I was smart enough to find places where I could walk or bike a lot, but you also had to just drive a lot, right? And I sort of hadn't really thought about it. And that was, like, when I was growing up, too. So one thing was I wanted to try to move and live in a big city. And I don't like New York. It's, like, I get a little claustrophobic when there's, like, a little, like, closing in. And then some personal stuff. I had been engaged, and we broke up. And so I was, like...
While in New Jersey.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This woman I had been dating from college, we got engaged, and then we broke up when we were living together in New Jersey, and it's like, I just need a clean break. And David Mazur, the executive director where I now work at Penn Environment, he had given me a call. We're PIRG and our now are all part of this larger network of groups, and so he had given me a call and said, I have a job, and we should come be the field organizer in Philly. Eventually I accepted that job and, moved here, and I never really spent much time in Philly. I'd been a few times. My dad went to college here, so I'd heard terrible horror stories about Philly from him. And he thought I was crazy.
I thought you said your dad went to undergrad here.
Yeah.
Oh, to Penn.
Yeah, he went to Penn at Wharton. He was here when Donald Trump was in school at Wharton. Doesn't remember Donald Trump. Got that phone call from the Boston Globe. But he, you know, Philly used to be really a crappy town. I mean, it was a dangerous, I think, city, and it was really run down. You know, if you go back into the 70s, maybe, early 70s, late 60s. And, you know, even I think until about 15, 20 years ago, it was sort of, you know, a shell of its former self. And the week I moved, actually, to Philadelphia was the week that the Inquirer had Philadelphia plastered across the banner headline.
Wow.
Because we had hit the all-time murder record.
Welcome to the city.
Exactly. So welcome to the city.
What were your emotions about it, then?
About that?
About moving to Philly. You have this new job.
I was excited. I mean, I sort of was excited to be in a new place, to be in a big city, you know, it's like, in some ways bigger, some ways not, than Atlanta. It's sort of different. But, you know, sort of like this iconic city, you know, everyone knows Philly. And it has more of that downtown feel. I lived in Center City when I first moved here than, like, most of Atlanta does. So it's like, I was really excited about it, I think, overall. And, I mostly just fell in love with the city. Like, I came to love that, A, I could walk everywhere I wanted to and take public transit, that I could, that it was, like, neighborhoody, so it's, like, big city, everything you want out of a city, right? Big, great, amazing museums and art, you know, great, you know, restaurants and food, you know, everything you sort of think of as a big city, but also, like, not, feels like there's, like, these neighborhoods and communities, right? There's smaller communities within communities, which maybe other big cities feel like that, but as far as I can tell, they don't. So I love that about it. It's really like, it's totally become my home, and I imagine I will probably die here. So, like, you know, I've just come to really love it.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Tell me about the work and that you've been doing in Philadelphia. Was there a steep learning curve to get used to a new place?
It was sort of, it was and it wasn't. Like, the second time around, everything's easier. So, right, like, both because you're a little more confident, you know a little bit more how it works, and, you're just a little better. So, like, yes, there is, because the politics are totally different, Pennsylvania versus New Jersey, totally different political landscapes. The issues you're working on are totally different, and the organization is sort of a different setup, and so... that was sort of a learning curve, but then, like, I felt like I could just dive right in. So I think when I first got here, did a bunch of work organizing health professionals around air quality regs or climate change, and I sort of had moved away. So in New Jersey, I had done a lot more of like some of the lobbying and advocacy work. I really didn't like that. Like, I can do it, but I don't like to schmooze and the way that that is. And so here I was really supposed to be like the field person. So I was supposed to be about organizing and engaging and educating the public and allies among different partners. And really building that sort of political power was my mission. And so I really enjoyed that and found that I really sort of thrived in that. But, you know, I sort of was just thrown in and dived right on in. I mean, and I think it was easier the second time.
You mentioned different politics.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
You know,
here in Philly.
So Pennsylvania is like, you know, it's a Rust Belt state in many ways. It's not totally a Rust Belt state, I know. It's purpley. It's got like this long fossil fuel history, right? So even among like people that should be your allies, there's this sense of like we need more coal or natural gas or whatever. Versus New Jersey doesn't have that history, right? There's a chemical industry history, and like I went to events at like refineries, right? So there isn't. It is, but the politics are like across the spectrum. Everyone's pro environment, you know, for the most part, you know, kind of thing, and you know, just more sort of in agreement with the issues you're working on.
Not so in Philly or in Pennsylvania.
And you know, there's definitely places. So in Philly and in the Philly suburbs, that's mostly still true. But the vast majority of the rest of the state, I mean, you know, within pockets, of course, it's definitely much more like pro fracked gas, pro coal. And that controls a lot of what happens in Harrisburg, in the legislature. And so that was sort of like what the, you know, if you think of like politics as like the art of the possible. The possible in Pennsylvania, what might be a good policy here is like a crappy policy in New Jersey. And what might be a good policy here, you know, is probably an amazing policy in Georgia. So, you know, it's sort of like understanding like how that plays out and then what people care about. And then the second thing is it's just bigger, right? Pennsylvania, much larger, bigger population and bigger geography. And so like I spent a lot of like probably the first 5 years going to every corner of the state doing organizing. I've probably been to, I don't know, probably been to 40 to 45 of the counties of the 67 counties at this point. Doing work, and you know, that's very different than New Jersey, which like every day you basically I could return to home. Like maybe I have to drive an hour and a half, but I always get back at home, you know, if I wanted to, right? Mm-hmm. Here it's like, oh, I might be 5 hours away.
Yeah. With that, those different circumstances, the fossil fuel history, the bigger size, the broader scope of the population, how has that changed your perspective on some of the issues that you work towards?
I think one thing is sort of trying to understand where people are coming from. So I think, you know, it's easy when everyone's sort of in general agreement to sort of say, okay, we're all headed in the same direction and we may have some disagreements about how we get there. I think here it's much more like there's diverging visions of the future in Pennsylvania and they're quite different. And, well, of course I think mine's right and I'm pretty sure it is. You know, I think, trying to be able to listen to people and understand where people are coming from is really important so that you can hopefully get them to move over time. And then at the same time, sometimes just saying that, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, I'm not going to, you know, there's a balance between listening and engaging and saying, yeah, that's fine, but you're just wrong and I'm just going to move past you. You know, like I'm just going to ignore that, right? And so I think it's hard because like, where do you draw that line? Do you go to deep coal country and make your mission to like convert those folks to clean energy champs? That's probably in my mind a waste of time, but it doesn't mean you totally ignore them, right? And so what that line looks like, I think it is a challenge in a state like Pennsylvania, and that's different, you know, than New Jersey and let alone like California or Massachusetts probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in terms of making, if politics is the art of the possible, the art of the possible is about how to find that middle ground and how to make both sides happy?
No, I don't think it's about that. I think that is a pitfall. I think the ideal that everyone should be happy or that, you know, that middle ground is always, like, there's a compromise, but there's still bad compromise. There's still, right, like, so it's understanding to me is important to just understand. I think it's just part of what we probably owe each other as humans. To try to understand each other. It doesn't mean I have to sacrifice my principles completely to come to some compromise. And then I think, you know, compromises, like, yeah, there are bad compromises. There are compromises that I think don't move us far enough towards a better world on, like, environmental issues or on any issue. And then there are compromises that do, and we should be supportive even if they don't get us as far. And I think here in Pennsylvania, that finding where that is really hard. And it's hard also because you have also folks, you know, who I totally agree with their beliefs, but who just want to hold a hard line. And I don't think that's going to get us very far. So I think the politics get, for all those reasons, a little more complicated than a state that's one side or the other.
Do you find yourself being at the front lines of negotiating where that line gets drawn in terms of compromise? But also having a constituency that is very strong in their beliefs of what they want. Do you find yourself in between, not only at the front lines of finding the compromise that works for the long-term interests, but also then having to communicate why that compromise is necessary to your more rabid, or more, rabid is not the right word. More,
I'll never call them rabid.
No, to your more outspoken and heartfelt supporters?
I think you have to communicate it well. I'd also probably argue that most of the public, or a huge chunk of it, like 40%, agree with the compromise most of the time, right? Like, there's people on either ends, but then, and you have to communicate, and a lot of times they're our best supporters, so we have to bring them along or articulate why we had to make these decisions. But I think actually most of the public's, like, usually pretty happy, right? It's like the loudest voices on either side that get upset or for whatever reason, right? So I'm sort of, you know, I sort of think most people are with us on that compromise because most people aren't that radical, right? Like, or even if they are, they sort of get it, right? Like, so, but yes, to your question, yeah, I think part of our job is to, like, articulate why we had to make the agreements we had to make, why we had to make the decision, and that we're not happy, that we're not done, right? That, like, the vision is still being made, but visions aren't made in one, you know, I always think of it as, like, aren't made in one fell swoop, right? It's, like, these steps along the path. And I think also, you know, I do, in a place like Pennsylvania, and probably if I worked even more in, like, a place that was probably even more politically anti-environment, I probably think part of our job is just to, like, you know, they always say speak truth to power. Part of our job is just to stand up for the people whose lives are being ruined. So sometimes your job is just to, like, be the thorn in the side and say, you know, I don't know, on fracking, like, I think we're sort of in a really, I just don't think it's going to stop. It's hard to see how we get better environmental protections. People's lives are getting ruined. And I just sort of tell people, like, yeah, part of it is, like, I'd rather just stand with people and say that's where I stood 30 years from now, even if we lose every day. There's also places where I think you just have to stand for what you believe in, but sort of different roles you play.
You mentioned visions aren't things that are made in one fell swoop. There are steps along the way. So I think that might be a nice transition point for us to talk about future visions for Philadelphia. To move into that kind of visioning period, I'll ask you a couple abstract questions.
Okay.
What are some of the things that you value most, that you love?
I mean, I think community is particularly important to me. I think, like, whether it's what I love about the city, that there's this sense of community and togetherness and, like, we're in it together, I think that's really important. Or just, like, some of the things we were talking about earlier about, like, growing up in Atlanta. So I think some sense of, like, we're in this together, I think is quite important. I think this ideal that, like, you know, it's like the golden rule. Like, I mean, I just think this ideal of, like, we all breathe, you know, part of, like, the reason I think the things of, like, we all breathe the same air and we all drink the same water is so important is this is the place where what you do affects me, right? Your choices affect my life and my choices affect your life, and sort of tied back to community, but it's sort of different of, like, I think therefore we owe it to each other to look out for each other, right? And what I want to have happen to me and my family, I want to have happen to you and your family. And that doesn't mean that we all have to have a perfect idyllic life, and it doesn't mean we all have to be millionaires or billionaires or whatever, right? Like, have everything we want, but that there are some basic standards that we owe to each other about how we experience life and how we impact each other's lives that we have to meet, and that I think that our society should just build around, which in some ways is all about community, I guess. So clearly I just care about community. I did write my senior thesis in college about community, as the case may be. So, So I, yeah, those are the things that I think probably, you know, I think the most about. And then, you know, from like the vision of the, you know, or whatever, like I think a lot about the environmental impacts. I mean, I think because of the experiences we were talking earlier around air quality and things like that, I think it, for me, it boils heavily down to environmental impacts. But I also think of it like other pieces. Someone parked in the no parking spot blocking the playground at, across the street from my house yesterday, and I was sort of annoyed, but I didn't go say anything about it, you know? And so, like, that frustrates me that I didn't go say anything about it. I should have probably, but, you know, so those sort of things. I don't know if that helps.
Is that, in a sense, justice, doing right? Or is that about following rules? Is that about other people and need that?
It's, justice is like, it's not really about, I mean, it is, justice to me becomes this thing of like, what I think doing right is and what you think doing right is different. And I know I think my version of doing right, maybe it's not in our case, but like, I know I think my version of justice is absolute, right? I think this is the reason community works better for me and that we're all in it together is because it's very easy for me to say, here's what I want my experience to be like, my family's experience, my friend's experience to be in our city. And I want, if I want that for my friends and my community, then you should have it for your friends and your community. And I think it avoids some of the problems with, I think it leads to justice, right? It leads to a just world. But I think when people talk about justice, it comes down to this absolute way that people can't communicate and connect on in a way that they can understand each other. Because it's just easier to be like, this is the right thing. And that probably comes from like a, you know, growing up in a household that's religious and Christian South, you know, but it's just hard to communicate. But it's very easy for me to understand what I want my family's experience to be like and what I want yours. And I think what we find is that when there's, what was I listening to the other day? There was some story the other day, about former Vice President Dick Cheney. There's this hypocrisy there, right? Because he was very, for a long time at times, like, supported a lot of anti-LGBTQ policies. But when his daughter came out as, right, lesbian, or when Rob Portman's son came out as gay, it totally changed the picture. How is that? So, like, to me, that was a communal decision. I just said, my son, my daughter is going to have this experience now, so I have to support, change my position. And I wish people would just get to that place sooner.
Tell me about some of the things that you fear, things that scare you in life.
Things that scare me in life. I think that actually more and more living in a city, the thing that scares me the most is that I don't feel like I, and I don't think other people feel like they can say things, about, say something when they see a problem around them. So I think this all the time, like on the subway, and this, right, I don't know if you remember the story, but like a year ago, I think it was like a year ago, someone was shot on SEPTA because they, do you remember this? They said something to two guys, I think they were like college age or maybe younger, on a subway car who were like harassing someone else. And then they got shot. And I think there's this problem where, I think for a city especially, the concept that I can't just, I get nervous about saying something, or I tell my wife, she gets a little road rage, and she always like flicks off people. And I'm like, don't do that. And she's like usually in the right, handling it maybe the wrong way. But like, I just don't know what that other person's going to do. And so I get more and more, I'm like, I'm sad and I'm probably a little scared by the concept that we can't articulate. I think in a city, like, it's dangerous sometimes to articulate when you think someone in your community is doing something wrong, because you're worried about what the reaction will lead to, whether that's literally getting shot or some financial thing or some whatever, right? That scares me a lot. And then I think the other thing that scares me a lot is that we sort of, on some of this stuff, try to stay hopeful, but every once in a while I think we as humanity are never, like, just too selfish. We're just never going to be able to see the long-term vision. So, like, it's good to talk about the 50-year vision. It's good to talk to the 100-year vision. But are we going to be able to understand that we have to make those decisions for the long-term about what's happening here and now? And I think we've evolved, of course, to just focus on the here and now. And that's, of course, makes sense. If you, you know, if you have an immediate hunger, if you have immediate whatever. But those two things, I think, I don't know, scare me a lot.
Do you see one of the fears you mentioned about not being able to articulate something that that you see that you think is wrong? Do you see that? How do you see that relating to the work that you do?
Well, I think it's easy to argue, you know, when you see something wrong and you're in a position of, like, advocating for change, it's a little easier because it's, like, in a, to steal a phrase, a safe space, right? You know what the rules of the game are. You sort of know who you're interacting with, and if you're smart about it, you mostly can control all that. I think it's more like a, it's like a hospitality courtesy thing to say it on a daily basis, to be able to say, you know, hey, you really shouldn't, I don't know, throw that cigarette on the ground, right? Sort of like, we were talking about this with my, so we live across the street from a park and a basketball court, and I went to the community meeting the other week, and they just put up no dog signs, and there's, like, been a little bit of a kerfuffle over it. And, you know, we're talking about it, and at some point I said, you know, the guy who works at the rec center said, like, but that's my job. I don't want you guys to ever say something to someone because I don't want to be responsible for what happens. And I sort of said, yeah, but at the same time, like, it's our rec center. Like, it's our park. We all live in this neighborhood. And we should be able to just say, hey, you got to pick up your dog shit. Or, hey, there's a no smoking sign right there. Don't smoke because there's kids around. And until we can... But the problem is that is in a much more uncontrolled atmosphere. And... I think it's a mixture of, it's an uncontrolled atmosphere, and we aren't that good at knowing when to call things out, I think, as people, and to do it in a polite, unemotional way, myself included, that it raises the stakes in a different way.
One last abstract question. Yeah. When you think about energy, yeah, what comes to mind?
Mm. Well, mostly I think about power plants. So I think I probably think heavily about, like, smokestacks and solar panels. I think they're, like, my two visions, and I think of it as, like, you know, think about all the pollution coming out of the smokestacks, and I think about, and all the consequences, because I've done a lot, I know a lot about that, and I think a lot about the, you know, the solar panels that I see, like, I was driving back from New Jersey yesterday, and there's solar panels on a farm in Bucks County, Snipes Farm, and you can see them from the highway. I'm like, oh, that's nice. You know, and so I think those are, like, probably my two images.
All right. Let's move into the visioning piece here, and we'll talk about the first one is sure. Philadelphia in the year 2067, so 50 years into the future.
Sure.
And again, this is your future vision. You can have an arc for your vision that's a story of growth or collapse or some sort of transformation. It could be status quo. It could be utopian. It could be dystopian. It's your vision. What do you see in Philadelphia in 50 years? The year 2067. What is life like? How is energy being used?
Yeah, that's a hard question. I, since I like to be hopeful, despite my depression at times, I think my image would be, you know, that communities as a whole are generating electricity for themselves. So whether that's solar or wind or geothermal or whatever, that there's a sense that, like, we as a neighborhood, as, like, maybe a block or something, I don't even know, have come together to figure out how do we produce enough electricity and energy to survive and to be happy. And, you know, I think there's a lot of opportunity to bring communities together around that. So, like, putting solar panels on the children's hospital in my neighborhood or, you know, the parking lot. And I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that as a community and think about energy as a locally grown resource rather than this thing that comes from afar. I think there's also a lot of opportunity to think about energy. I think, like, energy we don't really understand because it's just this thing that shows up, right? I flip the light switch and it just comes on. I mean, unless, except for the small set of people probably in the city that have, like, had their electricity turned off, right? Which is terrible. Like, I just think people don't think about the consequences of how they use it. And so, I'd like to think people have a better sense of that. I don't know exactly what that would look like.
But in 50 years, the people will have that better sense.
Yeah, and I guess then the city would look like, it would look like, I was just in Germany, and it's like, there's solar panels on almost every roof, right? It's like, solar panels are the norm, not the exception, right? They're, and probably for the city, that's the best way to go. So they're like the norm. They're what everyone's using. It's like you expect it on a house. If you don't have it for whatever reason, there's community solar that you can tap into to power your home, or community wind, or maybe some wind from mountains somewhere else. I mean, that is, you know, I think that is the vision I like to see. And then I think, and you know, we think about it in terms of electricity for our homes, but in terms of the rest, I think it's a city that is has a totally different transit system. That, you know, I take transit every day and I walk a lot of places. And in some ways, our transit system's great. You can get a set of places. But, like, once you get out of a certain, you know, basically along the two routes and, like, some of the bus routes, it takes forever to get anywhere. And I think the transportation system has to be a place where, like, I think anywhere in the city, from, like, the city, from City Hall, let's say, right, basically I should be able to get to anywhere on public transit in half an hour. And there's no real reason in the city, and I should be able to get anywhere in the suburbs within probably less time than half an hour, and, you know, and within 45 minutes or something, you know, or at least to major hubs in the in the suburbs. But it takes longer. I mean, you know, so than that. And I think if you got to the place where from City Hall, maybe not from my home, because I get, like, I can't always have what I want by my home, I could get anywhere in the city by in half an hour, and everyone could get to City Hall in 15 minutes. You could basically get anywhere in a reasonable amount of time.
How are people doing that in 50 years?
In 50 years. I think, I do think it is still public transit. I just think it is like an expanded subway. I think it's a mixture of like public transit, like subway system, rapid bus transit, to be honest. And then like express trains to the suburbs. I mean, and I think, you know, the center city area is like car free, right? So there's no cars there. You know, maybe some limited car use for people that live in the city. There's ways to do that. But mostly it's all, like, walking everywhere.
How are cars powered at that time? Were these buses, these rapid transit buses?
I think they're all powered by electric. I mean, I think ultimately the place we're going to have to go is that everything is electric powered. That it means we'll have to make some sacrifices, right? You can't, maybe we'll get charging technology figured out one day magically, but I think ultimately, it means, like, you'll have to stop every once in a while and take 20 or 30 minutes somewhere to recharge your car or your bus. And then that comes from solar. I mean, I do think that's, like, the, you know, or wind or what have you. I think that is where we are headed. And, you know, I think for most people on a day-to-day basis, you can do that. And, you know, it requires some pretty big shifts in how we operate. And then I think, ultimately, it's a place where most people don't have a car, right? Like, I think it's a place where, I mean, that's the other thing. If you had a transit system that let us get everywhere in 30 to 45 minutes within 5-county region, maybe an hour, you know, you wouldn't need a car on a daily basis. And maybe you borrow a car, maybe there's car share, maybe there's something else, maybe there's communal cars, I don't know. But, you know, if we got rid of half the cars in the city, it sort of would make everything go better in some ways. And I think, you know, a set of people today in the city already live that, right? Like, a lot of people in the city probably don't use, I know we don't use our car on a week, definitely on a daily basis, we don't probably use it on a weekly basis. We have a car for when we travel further away, a lot for my work, and, you know, sometimes for ease of use to get to Whole Foods or whatever. But my guess is most people in the city don't drive every day.
Okay. What about food? So food is a kind of energy.
Yeah.
What's the food story of Philadelphia? Are people just going to Whole Foods, or is there some sort of change that happens in 50 years?
Well, I think if our population ultimately doesn't totally rebound, you know, the vision would be...
Wait, is the population dropped in your 50-year future?
Ooh, that's a good question.
But what do you mean by rebound?
Well, you know, Philly's population drop, and then just rebroke the million mark a few years ago, and I think has not reached its peak again. I don't think we've exceeded the size of the city at its peak. So that's why we have all these vacant lots in part, right? We have a lot of people coming from the suburbs, but whatever. It probably depends on how you think, because, like, I think in my vision, more people live in the city, so maybe Philly does get a bigger population, but that's because there's a bigger push to move into cities and then, like, small city. Like, I think, like, the more we move into, like, a big cities and then smaller mid-sized city hubs and less of the suburbia... And I don't think we'll be there in 50 years, I have to say. Like, I think the cities will probably keep growing, but I think the suburban stuff and the other parts won't. It's just too soon. I think we'll be better off, and I think it's already happening, right? We're just seeing more people move into the cities. And
those trends will continue.
I think so. I think they will, because I think at least for our generation, it's what people want. Mm. And I think there's a lot of benefits now. And I think more and more it's where the jobs are going to be. Maybe they'll be in the suburbs, but they'll also be in the cities. And then I think...
For food?
My guess is we will still rely on places like Amazon, apparently, and Whole Foods, and grocery stores. I don't know if we'll ever get to the place where cities are capable of producing enough food to feed themselves. And I don't know if we'll get to a place where in 50 years where there'll be enough community gardens. I'd like to think that there'll be more community gardens, and I'd love to see, I don't know, I think we have enough space, so I think I'd like to see it. I don't know if enough people like gardening anymore. Just to see enough community gardens.
What does Philly look like in terms of its buildings? Is it more vertical, or is it spread out? Are there still old brick buildings around? What do things look like in 50 years?
I think it'll look pretty similar, actually. I think, you know, you'll see more verticalness in the downtown area, and maybe spreading out into West Philly, and maybe parts of North Philly. I think the rest, what you would see is potential reclamation of abandoned sections. So, I mean, you have to remember, a large chunk of the city is still abandoned. You know, if you go into Point Breeze and if you go up into Northeast Philly, there are tons of abandoned homes. And I think, you know, it's more likely that we reclaim those and they eventually get refurbished.
Into new buildings.
Or just, like, fixed up as homes, and not, like, rebuilt completely, then that we go completely vertical in neighborhoods outside of, like, West Philly and old, you know, outside of, like, University City, the great, I don't know, the ever-expanding University City, and Old City, and Center City, you know, then I just don't think the skyline will expand that much further out. Mm-hmm. And then I think in, like, yeah, in Center City, you might see more tall buildings and more verticalness as, you know, a bunch of the homes sort of get torn down, and that makes sense, but I think it will be contained within like that sort of region of the city.
Let's take a step forward into about 123 years into the future. That's the year 2140. So in about 125 years, how has Philly changed? Has it grown? Is it shrunk? At this point, there are some expectations for climate impacts beginning to really be even more of a daily impediment or a challenge to life than it is now.
Yeah, I think you'll see like the Delaware move in some, so then you'll see an abandonment somewhere by 125 years. I think knowing humanity, we will fight the good fight against these rising sea levels.
Do you think there'll be seawalls that help tidal rivers?
I think there will be, and I think they'll probably eventually fail unless we figure out really quickly how to deal with climate change. I think we'll fight the good fight for many years, and we'll sort of come to a realization and probably by 125 years that that's a losing battle and that we can't meet our needs as a society while doing it. So then I think in Philly, you'll see some encroachment in the southeastern part of the city, you know, an old city. I think there'll be some efforts to save the old part of the city because it's just too iconic. I don't know what that looks like. But I think you'll see the waterways sort of encroach in those areas. There's not a, you know, some of it's not that huge of a population, so you're sort of okay. But I think then beyond that, you'll see then the city sort of expand into the western sides of the city and the northern sides more and more. I think by 125 years out, you'll see, I don't know, at some point in there, the population's going to peak. But I still sort of believe, like, cities are the future, and so I sort of think, like, it will keep growing, and what we'll probably see is, like, some hubs in the suburbs, and then hopefully some other cities around the state sort of pop up, so you'll see some other Rust Belt cities, and that will impact us, right? Like, if that happens and they become viable alternatives, there's a little less need of growth in Philly, so it matters to us. I think the city will... But I think the city will keep growing for quite a while. I don't know what it peaks at. And then I think it sort of expands into the suburbs and have like additional, ideally, little ops, especially if my transit additional works out.
I like it. So will Philly experience any of the refugees that are fleeing from the coastal areas?
I think so. I think we will see a lot of growth from that. I think it will happen sooner. So I think like probably somewhere between that 50-year and 125-year mark. Somewhere between that 50 and 125-year mark, we'll have some tensions among refugees coming in. Because I think most of the projections, so, like, end of the 21st century, right, end of, like, 2090, 2100, right? And so I think a lot of that will happen. There'll be a ton of tension and push. And then by 2145, I think is where we are, it will sort of have settled out. And I think it will add to the city's population growth quite significantly. Some people will move to the suburbs and other places, but I think some people will just move into the city, and it will sort of settle out.
With the increased heat indexes expected in Philadelphia and with the greater precipitation expected, how is Philly different? Does it look different? Are the buildings different? Are the way people move around different?
I just don't know if we have, like, the wherewithal to really build, like, an underground system of cold caves to, like, keep us cool between, like, I think you'll see some of it. Like, I think I could see...
Wait, what is this vision? Like, there would be underground caves to keep people
cool? You
ever,
like, in Chicago, like, my sister went to Northwestern, and there were underground caves for the winter time to, like, tunnels between the buildings. Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll get there. I could see it where, like, the buildings become more interconnected. So you can get in and stay in your nice AC and cooler areas. I think we'll see more green roofs on the whole to try and deal with the island heat effect in the city. And I think the real question is, like, do people still play outside and want to go places as much? So I think what will happen is that will still happen, but it will happen in a shorter season, right? Like, in July, no one really wants to walk anywhere, right? It's too hot now. And now, then it will be like, maybe in June and even late May and early September, there'll be like a longer period where the heat is so unbearable, you'll see less people outside unless they have to be.
Does that impact the way that Philadelphia's parks systems work? Are there less parks in Philly? Is Fairmount still a big space? Are the squares still a part of the community sense in Philadelphia?
Yeah, I think it does impact things. I think what you'll, I think the parks will mostly stay. I think they'll get a little bit different use. I think we'll sort of realize that they have other benefits besides places to play. So I think they're still around.
Kind of uses are you picturing?
Well, like things like the fact that they're not like, they're heat sinks for the city. So like if you're trying to keep the heat out, right, you want those parks in place and you want green spaces. If you want, you know, good healthy air, you want that stuff. I think you might also see some of them build in like community garden opportunities or farm parks that people could use. I mean, I sort of remember also as a child, like always having a lot of fun at summer camp farming. I went to summer camp and it was a farm, and I don't know, they got us to do labor for fun. So, you know, I think you could see that happen. I think what you'll see though is like less play in the summer outside during those hottest days.
How about dealing with the precipitation? Do the buildings or just the way people move around? I mean, you mentioned the interconnected buildings as a way to continue walking. So walking is still a big part of life in 2140.
I think it will be. I think it just won't be as often, but I think it will be. And I think if we can, I just think people in cities will walk.
Do cars still play a role in 2140?
I think mostly not. Like, I think at that point, like, people don't own cars. So you either have, like, the public transit system or, I don't know, some community car share thing, maybe. Like, there are some cars because people need to get to places. But most people won't own their own car. Like, they'll, like, have a car share, they'll rent a car, they'll, like, take a Uber, Lyft, whatever's future. Or maybe cars just become, like, I mean, it's hard to know. Like, it's totally possible with self-driving vehicles that we see, like, you know, everyone gets in their own car, but they're, like, community-owned, right? Like, they're just part of the transit system. Mm-hmm. I think you'll see stuff like that happen. I think people, except for, like, the diehards who love their cars as cars, like, won't own cars, especially in a city, the traffic will become so unbearable that I think people just won't want to. Mm-hmm.
With the energy scene, how is Philly powered in 2140? Do fossil fuels play any role?
If they do, I think we're totally screwed. I think they won't. I mean, I do. I think the question isn't, do fossil fuels end? I think the question is, what's the timeline and how much damage has been done? Right? Like, I think the writing's on, I mean, not only because they're just running out so they can't exist forever. Like, I think the economic writing's on that wall, and it's just a question of, like, how quickly it goes. So by 2145, I think they're all gone. I think, you know, there may be nukes still. I mean, God forbid, but there may be nukes. There may be something like fusion, if they ever figure it out, which I doubt they will. But, you know, there may... But I think there'll be more, like, solar and wind and big energy efficiency efforts, you know. And one of the benefits of a city is it is just more efficient. And I think... you know, if we're not going to have the same cheap abundance of energy, people sort of realize the value of it, I think, is part of the problem. We don't realize the value it provides us. And so as people realize that, they'll want to become more efficient.
Hmm. Let's move forward to the third visioning piece, which is 2312.
Yeah.
So almost 300 years into the future. As a reference point, 300 years from today in the past is in the 1720s.
Yes.
Right? So North America is mostly Native American at this point. The nations are still very strong. There's a few inroads of colonialism from the Europeans on the coast.
Yeah.
Wood, by far, is the dominant energy source. Coal isn't even on the scene. So let's leap 300 years into the future, almost, and talk about your 2312. What is life in Philly like?
I mean, I think the first question becomes, like, what's our government look like? Like, mm-hmm. I don't even know if we have, like, the U.S. anymore, right? Like, I think at some point, I tend to think by 300 years, something's going to happen. Either we're going to break down into individual state governments or regional governments. It's going to be one world government. I don't really think that will happen, but who knows?
So at the same time that there is more regional influence in government, there may also be a global structure?
No, I think it's either or. I can't tell which way it's all going to go. I tend to think the one world government thing never happens because people want local control and we're all so different. Mm. So I think that will never happen. So then I think you have like more regional things. But and then I think, you know, so maybe like Philly and New Jersey become a nice little region together.
But Philly exists. Philly as a city is still there.
I think so. I think there are these things, right? Like we do sort of know for thousands of years of history... I mean, it sort of matters how much the sea levels rise, let's be very clear. So maybe it moves in a good bit. But we sort of do know this thing of, like, there are certain places on the globe that have an inherent value that make them thrive. So one of them's always been being on water sources, which Philly still does, right? Another is, I think, unless there's major population shifts in the U.S. in a really weird way, like, the population is shifting out west, but it's also shifting south. I think it's, like, a sort of still centrally located place. And you sort of have to think, actually, over time, in 300 years, with climate change, it will get so hot in the south that it will push people back north some. And so I sort of think all those things mean Philly still exists in some function. It's hard to know. I mean, like you said, it's sort of hard to know. It's hard to know if we find aliens finally. So, you know, it's like, it is a little hard to know what the thing looks like, but I think it's sort of like, you know, Rome. Rome's been around for thousands of years, and I think Philly came later, but my guess is there's a set of things about its location that means it will exist in some form or function.
Is it bigger or smaller?
Well, I think in 300 years, the population of Earth is smaller. So I think what we have seen happen, admittedly, is right as populations become more educated and more knowledgeable and more advanced as economies, right, that population sort of evens out and eventually decreases, right, because you're not having 8 children anymore.
Yeah, demographic transition.
Right,
yeah.
And I think that's going to happen everywhere. And so I think one, the population of the Earth will be smaller. I think ultimately some of it is the population of the U.S. will probably, of the United States region, will be larger. And I'm not sure about Philly. And I say that because we just have such big space compared to our population. And so when you ultimately think about like where refugees from Africa, from the Pacific Asian island are coming from, it's just the best option sometimes. It's going to be the United States. And if we could just get over our hatred of immigrants... you know, I think it just makes a ton of sense, right? from a population density perspective. And so I think in 300 years that will have happened. So I don't know what Philly's population will be like. I mean, and it's worth noting, like, the city footprint may move, right? So I think it's sort of interesting. I don't know if there's any good historical studies of, like, cities creeping in location over time. But my guess is there are some cities that have creeped in location over time as sort of like they expand and then they shrink in sort of areas. Or in the next 300 years with climate change, we'll sort of see that. We'll see cities sort of move, right, a little bit. Like a mile or two, which would be enough to deal with a lot of the problems.
Yeah. Oh, what's the energy scene like?
Ooh.
300 years.
No fossil fuels, though. That's for sure. I don't know what that thing... I mean, it's hard to know, right? Like, 300 years... So do we even know what the energy source is we're going to use, right? Like, are we still, and maybe we are still solar and wind because that's sort of always here, right? But have we discovered, you know, fusion or some way to have some totally, you know, bacteria that creates, right? Like, there's that whole investigation. I think it's really hard to know what energy looks like. I think what it will look like will be relatively clean compared to what we're doing today. That is that we will have at least learned our climate lesson, and the hard way probably. And so that lesson will force us into something clean, but if we've probably not invented it yet, you know? I just can't imagine we've invented what we're going to be using in 300 years.
What about what Philly looks like as far as buildings and trees and that sort of thing? What do you see?
I bet we will have in 300 years, I bet it will look different. I bet it will look more, I think there'll be like more, less just building, and more of an interplay between, I think at some point the climate stuff is going to force us to rethink how we build our cities. And I think 300 years will be enough time to reshape parts of the cities and reclaim parts as parks and open spaces and, you know, things like that. But it's going to take that much time for us to sort of be beaten down by destruction. You know, it's like sort of this thing of like, I can't imagine we'll learn the lesson the first five times. But I think 300 years will have like sort of restructured the city. So it'll be like more like almost like a living thing where there's more green space, there's more fluidity between it. Maybe there's little pockets of like, you know, instead of just having Center City and West Philly, maybe there's more like pockets of like, I don't know, little miniature cities almost within it or something. I don't know.
So the neighborhood sense of Philly has grown into they're little cities.
I think so.
Yeah. Community is a very important thing in your world. What is the social life like in 300 years in Philadelphia? Are people living with families all in one building, or is it still individual single family residences?
I think we'll move. Well, in Philly, it's hard, right? Because I still, in 300 years, I guess maybe we won't have the same homes anymore, right? Like, you'd have to tear down a huge chunk of the city to get there. But I guess I do think, like, yeah, we'll move into more, like, these buildings that have a bunch of people in them and a bunch of communal needs in them, right? And I think that will be good and bad, probably. Like, I think they somewhat segregate communities more, right? Like, you don't walk out on your street as much. You just like, I don't know, my little sister sort of lives in one of these in Atlanta. And she just like, she goes in and out of her building and half of what she needs is there. And, you know, so I think that will happen at some point. And whether it's the whole city or just a good chunk of it, I think we'll see more of those. They sort of make more sense.
Mm-hmm. 300 years in the future, how are people moving around transit-wise?
Well, I think, people move out of their... I mean, I think in 300 years, like, if you think about, like, mostly what you transport yourself for, I think if the city changes enough, mostly what you end up needing to transport yourself for is your job. And I think if you take, like, the teleworking thing to the extreme, you start to see people not needing to go anywhere for their job. Now, you need to go sometimes to meet in person, but I think it will become, like, I don't know, holograms or whatever, right? Like, they'll just be... Or virtual interfaces, right? I mean, if you just see what's happened... We'll get to this point that at least for a lot of jobs, we won't need to do it. I think we'll be heavily roboticized. I mean, I think even 125 years, we'll be like heavily roboticized. So like the jobs where you actually have to physically build something, will be taken care of heavily by robots that are managed by other people. And so then I think you have to travel less, and then it works well if you have, like, stuff in your community that you don't have to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So then I think the question for the city becomes, like, do those communities actually have some heterogeneity to them that they then, like, represent the whole community? Mm-hmm. But I think you'll see, therefore, less transportation, probably more public transit, or, like, the car thing where no one owns a car or whatever. Maybe personal flying cars, I don't know. But, like, I think that, you know, if I just think about it, I think, like, that will, those two features will shift over the next 300 years, the need to travel on a daily basis, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I think most of us, we travel to work, and then, you know, everyone's going home once a week to go grocery shopping. Mm-hmm. And even then, it's just, like, you less transportation need.
Yeah. Is there anything else about either your visions of the future or your sense of Philadelphia that you want to share?
I don't think so.
Thank you so much for taking time today.
Of course. This was awesome.